91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. A scan of the towering high-rises which abut Biscayne Bay obscures the long human history of South Florida. Before the village of Miami was settled in the late 18th century, indigenous people lived and gained sustenance from the bay for 12,000 years. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. This hour we learn more about the history of Native tribes in Florida and how they came to their current configurations. We mostly know of the modern Seminole and Miccosukee tribes, but there were others in the lineage. We'll hear from both Miccosukee and Seminole tribe members, as well as the History Miami CEO. Stay tuned, Topical Currents up next. After the news.
Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, it's Tuesday's Topical Currents. Well, an hour of South Florida history awaits us. We'll learn how Native populations adapted to the unrelenting population of whites and evolved into modern times.
We'll meet two individuals, one from the Seminole community and one from the Miccosukee community.
From the Seminoles, it's Samuel Tommy of the Bird Clan. He's an artist, musician, videographer, and Everglades activist. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
He also has his flutes with him.
He does, his Native American flutes. Two of them, one in A and one in E.
Thank you.
Also with us from the Miccosukee community is William Osceola, a language and culture teacher at the tribe's school. Welcome to you.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Plus, for an overview, we have archaeologist George Zemanillo. He's the CEO of the History Miami Museum. Welcome back to you, George. Always good to see you.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, gentlemen, let's start with you, George. Just if you would give us a brief history of Native American tribes of South Florida, who they were, which tribes, when they arrived.
Well, South Florida is unique in that the Native American tribes that we recognize today in South Florida are not the same as the prehistoric people. Same ancestors, I believe, but the names are different. So South Florida archaeology has revealed that we have Native American people here going back over 10,000 years. With sites identified in Southern Dade County, the Cutler Fossil Site, showing a possibility of human remains associated with Pleistocene animals. You know, you're talking about saber tooth here, mammoth, mastodon, dire wolves, which you only see on Game of Thrones today. But it shows that there are people inhabiting South Florida over 10,000 years ago, and that's really important. And then later on, people move on, and most of those populations were chasing big game and hunting and a different environment back then, a lot drier and cooler weather. Then you move on to about 5,000 years ago with the formation of the Everglades. With the Everglades we know today, the water levels rising, and these tree islands populating most of the interior South Florida, and the rivers and the Atlantic coastal ridge along the Atlantic Ocean, where settlements and other campsites started popping up. And those are the people introduced pottery down here to South Florida, dug out canoes, and they started using the waterways. Of course, later on, when European contact occurs in 1513, it's what the Europeans called the people that were here, the Tequesta Indians. And so those are different people altogether.
So these were the people of the Miami Circle?
Exactly.
Vintage?
These are the ones that had a main village on the mouth and north bank of the Miami River and populated the south bank also where the Miami Circle is today. And then really populated all of South Florida. And then you had the Calusa Indians on the southwest coast of Florida. And these populations extended all the way through the Keys, Florida Keys. And these are the same people that we recognize as living throughout here and leaving. The last Tequesta Indians are said to have left to Cuba in canoes. Pushed out of South Florida in 1763. But now by this time, we have Creek Indians already moving into Florida, escaping pressures from the United States government from the Alabama and Georgia area, and originally in northern Florida, then central Florida. But by the mid-1700s, we believe that there were definitely Seminole Creek Indians
now,
living here.
Before the emigration to Cuba and the Tequesta, were they also ravaged by disease that were introduced by the European?
That's what the documentation says. You know, we have only European accounts, of course, so they're kind of slanted. But there are many people in there, and including many people of the Jesuit priests that kept journals and throughout different many attempts at forming missions on the north bank of the Miami River. There are two different attempts, one in the 1500s, one in the 1700s. And the whole attempt there was to make them Christianize. And that happened in Cuba also. And there they do describe the conditions and the harshness and what was happening to the native populations with the introduction of European diseases.
And when the Seminoles came and they were moving from the north, why did they come here?
Well, it's a story across the Southeast. I'm sure a representative here can help you out with that. But it's a story of being pushed out and relocated to areas that the United States didn't want yet. That's why I say
I see.
And it started in northern Florida during the First Seminole War. This is after they take over parts of Florida. They wanted land that was owned by the Spanish at the time. So then you have Andrew Jackson pushing Creek Indians away. Then during the Second Seminole War, this is 1835, they say that they can't even stay in Central Florida anymore. They want it completely out of Florida. And that's where you have the resistance, and you have famous Battle of Okeechobee. You have the Dade Massacre, which, of course, we live in Miami-Dade County, but Francis Langhorne Dade, wasn't even down here ever. This is a battle that took place between Fort Brooke, modern-day Tampa, and Ocala, Fort King. And that's a massacre that occurred on December 28th, 1835. And what happened there was, again, pushing resistance. The difference during the Second Seminole War is they decided to attack plantations and the homes and the populations, the native populations, to force them out that way. And the Seminoles resisted and were successful. And over 100 U.S. infantry were wounded, and only 3 Seminoles were wounded.
So Dade was killed in the current Micanopy area?
Exactly, and that was led by Chief Micanopy at the time, yeah. Chief Osceola was attending to other businesses somewhere else, but Chief Micanopy became known for that battle.
I'd like to bring in Samuel Tommy and William Osceola. As we said in the introduction, Samuel, you're part of the Seminole community, and William, you're part of the Miccosukee tribe. For those of us who may not be up to speed on reality, maybe you could both comment on this. We sometimes hear that these two tribes have little love lost on one another. What is the truth of the matter? And William, would you like to begin?
I think historically that's been more true in the past, just because of how our respective tribes approach, you know, the government and becoming modern, integrated with the modern world. But now I would say that's more on a macro level, I guess. It's less tangible for like a tribal member to get an idea of that, because we have cousins, aunts, uncles. I have, you know, those family members who are tribal members of the Seminoles. I don't have any animosity towards them, obviously. He's actually the father of really, really close childhood friend of mine. So there's no
Samuel,
real sense.
Samuel, you're saying.
Yeah.
And Samuel, what is your take on that? You must hear that.
Of course. Back in the, back when the tribes were organized, back in 1957, the Seminole Tribe of Florida was organized. And I believe in 1960, the Miccosukee Tribe of Florida was organized. Back in those days, the traditional teachings taught that we cannot give into the government system. We cannot become federally recognized people. So therefore, there were a lot of oral confrontations at that time, and there were differences, but the Seminole Tribe was, you know, established at that time. So there were disagreements, and the traditional teachings was that if we become traditionally recognized and become as a tribally organized, a governmental functioning, as in today's terms, our youth and our ways of life will deteriorate. So that's one of the reasons that we came down here. That's one of the driving forces that drove us out here, is to be independent and to be a free people and to exercise our God-given rights. And that was our driving force. That has been always been our tradition, is that we have our rights that we've had for centuries, and that it did not make sense to us that, you know, there's a European or a foreign people telling us how to live. And that's what started our people to move from Georgia and Alabama areas into Florida. We were resisting the change that was happening. And also at one point, the Florida was under British. And so we were seeking freedom. But The difference is that a lot of tribes or a lot of people wanted to hang on to the traditional teachings, and the Miccosukee wanted to have a traditional community and culture that they can protect, which they later start their tribe, I believe, in 1960. And what they had was that they had the community as the tribal council.
So what does that mean exactly?
If a decision needs to be made through the tribal government, the members are the ones that vote on the issues themselves. The Seminole tribe has a general counsel, which is an attorney, and more of an indirect democracy where we can say we want this, but the Seminole tribal council can go behind doors and make decision on their own if they feel like it.
Yeah, we have a more of a direct democracy on the Miccosukee reservation. You know, it's like a one-to-one vote. So whatever the general council, which is, you know, adult enrolled members, whatever the majority vote is, it's up to the business council, which consists of like the chairman, the assistant chairman, secretary, treasurer, the lawmaker. It's up to them Yeah, it's up to them to follow through whatever the general council's will is.
In this migration from Alabama and Georgia, from the Creek area, how did the African slave or those who were seeking freedom tie in to the tribes?
What happened back then, late 1700s, the escaped slaves were coming into Florida area. There was a point where the slaves that have lived in Florida areas became allies with the Seminoles. And
we could understand their struggle very well.
Yeah, we understood their struggle. And like I said, we are a nation of generations and centuries. So we have an understanding of what democracy is and what human rights are. We feel that. We even feel that today.
What does it mean when we hear that the clans, you're both in the Bird Clan, even though you're in different tribes, what does it mean that clans supersede the tribal governments?
That's just because, you know, it's like the clan system is like a cultural thing. You know, you get that from your mother, and we hold women in high regard. You know, we're a matrimonial society type thing. Matrilineal? Is that the word I'm looking for?
Yeah.
So what that means, like on a personal level, is if there's like a larger disagreement, they want to settle it like on a family level within the clan first before they take some official approach.
I see.
Like that's generally the rule they go with. Try and resolve it with the family first before you have to take it to something like tribal court or a situation like that.
Now, how many clans are in the South Florida area in the two communities?
I would say for the Miccosukees, we recognize about 6 clans, you know.
And how do you get your names?
You're talking about our traditional names or our English names?
Like the Bird Clan.
Oh, the Bird Clan? Would you like to talk about?
Yeah.
Okay, the Bird Clan would start from the mother, from the grandmother. So it goes back hundreds of years. And the Bird Clan or other clans, it seems to be talking about how at one point they came to... they came to where each families could be characterized, where I would see it as a evolution of the way we think and so forth, the way we behave, eventually became identifiable. We have our own creation stories as well, but as far as the clans, it goes back hundreds of years. And we have ceremonial grounds that we still practice that today. And we have like responsibilities out there as well. Each clans have different responsibilities and different roles at our ceremonial places. And so it can be respected on a family level, individual level, or on the cultural and spiritual levels.
We're going to take a short break. We'll hear more about the clans. We're speaking about native tribes of Florida, in this case, the Seminoles and the Miccosukees, with Samuel Tommy of the Seminole community, William Osceola from the Miccosukees, and also with us, George Zamanio is CEO of History Miami. We'll be right back.
And we return, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. It's today's Topical Currents. We're glad you've joined us. We continue with William Osceola and Samuel Tommy and also George Zamanio, CEO of the History Miami Museum. George, give us a little bit of an overview on the importance of the three Seminole Wars that the Native tribes call the 100-Year War. It was a tremendous event in the course of the history of Florida and the United States.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the Seminole Wars go back to 1815 to 1817, not exact date. But it's the longest war in U.S. history and one of the most costliest, and many lives lost. And it's really because, you know, the government, different stages, trying to push out Native American tribes out of Florida. And as they moved down the state, as I mentioned before, at first it was mostly in northern and western Florida, northwest Florida, with Andrew Jackson. But later on, they start, you know, really hitting the plantations and where the Seminole Indians were living in Central Florida, in a place, by the way, in an area where they had said it's okay to live here. This is your reservation, and then they changed their mind. So what happens is you start getting these skirmishes and these battles that are really significant and really start shaping the Seminole tribe across and Seminole people across the whole state of Florida, and eventually by the end of the Third Seminole War, you know, they're mostly in South Florida. But many of the forts that you see today, you mentioned before, you know, you see Fort Lauderdale and Fort Brooke and Fort White. These are all place names, really, where forts were established in major cities today.
Fort Dallas.
Yeah, and then Fort Dallas right here at the mouth of the river later on. But Fort Lauderdale is a good example there. You know, there's still remains of the fort that were found along the river, along the New River in Broward County.
And the whole purpose of them was to wipe out the Native
fortifications,
Americans.
Right. They're trying to establish fortifications to wipe out Native Americans. There's a big battle here. Even a future president, Zachary Taylor, in a skirmish with Sam Jones. And, well, Sam Jones Islands, the area in Pine Island, today there's a development in western Broward County. Where we found archaeological evidence along Pine Island Road there that indicates there were Seminole occupations that were going back over 100 years. So very significant towns and villages all along this area.
I didn't realize, you know, in reading about these wars, that there were many firsts. Like, it was the first war the Marines ever lost, evidently. It was the only war that the Navy set foot and went inland to fight. And that they actually lost all these wars, and they were the only wars they had lost.
Exactly. And even though the U.S. declared victory, it was never. And that's why we say the unconquered people, because the Seminole people did survive. And now, you know, there were only about 100 or so individuals that ended up coming to South Florida. But that is the foundation, the basis for the future generations here. It's also important to know that, you know, territory and the environment was everything back then. Here is the infantry and the Navy moving into an area that's uncharted waters for them. They don't have no idea how treacherous the Everglades or the Big Cypress could be, or, you know, sawgrass or pinelands in Central Florida. And the Seminoles had a big advantage there. They knew the territory. They knew the land from living in it for years, from working it. So they had a big advantage.
William Osceola, you're a young man and also you teach language and culture. What does that heritage mean to you and to those you teach?
I would say it means survival, really. It's that simple. Part of our constitution, the Miccosukee Constitution, it's written in there, we have to keep the language alive and we have to take care of the land. Like, those are part of that. That's part of being the Miccosukee, being recognized as a tribe. And I try to relate it to the kids as a way to think about, this is like what kept your ancestors alive. This is a means to protect yourself out there, because, you know, look at our history. The outside world has been pretty hostile to us as a whole, so you always want to stay protected. So everything is geared towards survival. So it's really that simple. It's a means of survival.
Do you find that the children that you're teaching, what grades do you teach, by the way?
Primarily, I teach 3rd, 4th, and 5th, but I started off at the school down there in the pre-K level, and I've taught all different grades from first to 12th grade.
Do you find that the younger children have an interest in knowing about their heritage and...
The younger children are sponges, man. Like, that's one thing I picked up in pre-K is they're so willing to learn if you just are willing to show that you're interested. Even with the older kids, as long as you show that you're interested, that gets them interested, you know?
I guess this is more of a general question, but you were talking about Samuel before, how you still observe a lot of the same rituals that your forefathers did. How have you adapted to modern times? I mean, how have you moved into the 21st century? And I'll ask you both that, really, because in terms of your teaching, I'm thinking also, William. But how have you blended that with maintaining who you are and your rituals?
We do have a private school where I come from, Big Cypress Seminole Indian Reservation, which is south of Lake Okeechobee. At our private school, they have cultural classes and languages, and that's our main means of surviving. And what I find very difficult is our language compared to English. You know, it is like day and night. It is very, very, very difficult. There was a time I spent time away from my community, about 2 or 3 years, 3 years at the most. And when I went back, you know, I tried to speak my language, and my tongue was getting twisted and tied up.
Which language? I understand there are three languages. Which one do you speak?
I speak Miccosukee. I would say 70% or 60% of the Seminole tribal members speak Miccosukee. And we are also from the Miccosukee culture. The other percentage that makes up the tribe, Seminole tribe, is the Creek. So they have a Creek language. And I speak Miccosukee, and my family, my culture is from the Miccosukee itself. And the way we adjust to everything is that we try to make sure our young people go to colleges and so forth. And they encourage them to get more education and so forth. But even families, young fathers and mothers that are taking care of their children, teaching them how to speak their own language and their own cultural ways, is a very, very important role. And we're thankful for that young people are doing that. And it's not really a matter of moving into a new culture. It's a matter of observing what is there and appreciating what's left and making a decision, which direction are we going to go from here. For us, it seems to be a defining time for our identities. And a lot of our young people are interested in our languages and our ceremonials or dances and songs, which is great to see. So it's a time where we're making a deep internal decisions, and I feel the what I call an unconquered spirit. A lot of young people are showing that they know who they are, and they identify with their ancestors and the strong beliefs, and so we see ourselves as a different nation, and we see ourselves as the nation that we have always been. And like I said, we seem to be coming back into an identity.
That's interesting. A good time. And William?
William, actually, that the term unconquered comes up a lot. Is that something you feel that helps keep your culture unified?
Yeah, I think it does. It keeps that spirit of oneness. You know, that's something I remind the kids every day, almost like, you know, we are our own people. We've earned that right to live our life the way we choose to live it, which is the traditional cultural way, hopefully. And part of that is, again, because we were unconquered. You know, I try to use that as a motivator to show, you know, anything's possible, because you look at the United States, it's such a huge entity. And to think like, oh, us as a people were able to resist that subjugation, that assimilation, you know, that's a pretty big deal.
And where are you linguistically as far as what you choose to use?
I'm actually, the language is a bit of a reclamation project for me, because when I lived part of my life in Connecticut when I was younger, so I lost it. Well, I used to be fluent, completely fluent, but now it's more
in
like...
In Miccosukee?
Yeah, in Miccosukee. Now I can speak some of it. It's a little bit of a mission. I can understand it pretty well, but it's still not, you know, where I wish it was. Like, I can't conversationally speak with my grandparents.
Okay.
But this also gives me the view of, like, you know, this is why it's really important to keep this alive. You're missing this link. Like,
so are you teaching or are they being taught the languages?
Yeah,
in the
I run through that every day with them, okay. You know, like how just basic stuff, even sometimes just how to say hello to them or ask them how they're doing, things like that.
Samuel, you're a consummate artist. You do ceramics. You do you're a silversmith. You're a musician. You're a filmmaker. You're an artist. You paint. And you brought those two flutes, the Native American flutes, with you. Would you play something for us?
Oh, yeah. I can try that.
Which flute is that? It's really beautiful.
This
it's
one's
beautiful.
Made out of cedar. It's a Native American flute. It's in a minor key. And it's also in a key of E. And I go to events and so forth. Like, we were showing the Miami Rivers film. And it's
that part of that Celebrate Water.
Yeah, it's called Celebrate Water. That's the event that we had here in Miami. And before we all begin, I do a prayer flute song. And we just take a moment and, you know, kind of meditate on a little bit. And this one is that I think of a story that was taught to me when I was young, which is that the Creator came down heaven from heavens and he materialized a vessel on this planet, which was covered by water, completely covered by a blue water. And he sat in his vessel and contemplated how this earth would turn out and so forth. And so this is what I'm thinking about, and this is more of a meditation for me as well, but this is what I share.
Did you, were you taught that or did you just learn it on your own?
I do a lot of meditations out in nature, and where I live, we're right next to millions of acres of Big Cypress National Preserve. That's on the west side of us. And so I go out there, I take my time, I walk around. When I was younger, I used to go out there and hunt and kill animals for food. Nowadays, I go out there with my cameras and just take a walk, or I just take my flute and go out there, or I'll do meditations out there derived from our traditional meditative teachings. And when I go out there, I like to go out to some places that, you know, that are been there for a very, very long time. There's one particular place that I like. It used to be a ceremonial grounds by the previous tribes that were here before us. There was a tree that's there on the west side where the tree is a little cypress place with water in it. There's a cypress tree standing there, which is over 500 years old. There's also a plant there, which is called ghost orchid, and it's very hard to find, but there's plenty there. I like to go there and meditate or play my flutes. And a lot of these flutes, tunes or melodies I come up with, this is where I get them. They just kind of arrive from heavens, or I don't know where they come from, but it's a meditation for me.
William, tell us more about you, William Osceola, and some of your pursuits and interests.
Actually, I went to school for computer animation, so there's a lot of artistic abilities on the tribe. Like, I see it with my students, too. So I went to school in Full Sail for that. I had a lot of pressure from my grandparents and others to go to different, more Ivy League type schools, because I did fairly well on my testing stuff. Actually, that's one thing I want to make notice of is our school under reservation. Like, even people under reservation tend to not know what's really going on, so they might have a negative view, but we're doing some good work with some really great students there.
What's the name of the school?
The Miccosukee Indian School, and that's for tribal members. But yeah, so I went to school there and then did testing, got really great scores, so I know that you can do great things at that school. So I got some pretty good offers from Ivy League schools, but in my opinion, a lot of those schools are just living off of reputation, you know. I've seen some of the people who have gone and graduated to those schools, and I'm very skeptical. So I went to what I figured was right for me.
Well, Full Sail is supposed to be a great film school.
I went for the animation. I can only speak for that department, and it was great. Like, I was taught by Disney animators. People worked on stuff like Shrek 2 and Avatar. So it was a great program, and I'm actually trying to incorporate what I learned there into some of the programs down on the school, because again, we have a lot of students who have great artistic ability with like drawing and things like that, so want to nurture that so they can express themselves.
Are all the teachers at the school members of the tribe?
No. Most of the native staff are in the language department with myself. There are a few in the daycare and one runs the kitchen, but most of the staff is from Miami or wherever. But most of the staff is good people. They're pretty dedicated to the mission, which is to get the kids as much knowledge as they can.
So it's top flight technologically.
We're trying to get to that level. We're trying to. A teacher and I just went to a science conference. We're trying to find ways to get more programming engineering into the school because the tribe wants self-sufficiency. We want the students to be able to take over departments that the tribe runs, like the water resource department. They actually take the kids every year on two studies where they measure water levels and things like that. So they're very aware of what's going on environmentally.
So they're aware of the sea level rise and
the phosphorus levels and everything like that. Yeah.
Right.
We like to talk to the elders because they'll tell us about how things used to be 70 years ago. And there's been a big shift now. Like, they told us about how there used to be like clouds of birds everywhere out there, but that's not something you see anymore.
Right.
It's a lot of stuff has been taken from us. In that sense.
And a lot of people probably aren't aware that really the start of so-called Everglades restoration really began in the late 1980s because of the tribe and the hiring of Dexter Layton and actually bringing a lawsuit against the state of Florida for not using its own water quality standards.
Yeah, we deal with a lot of, like, with the land we have, you know, like I said earlier, in the Constitution, we have to take care of the land, but that's hard when you have real estate and farming people dumping runoff, and that just flows down south into our water supply. And it's not just our water supply, it's the water supply for South Florida. So
Right. People
are shooting themselves in the foot. We're trying to do what we can to bring awareness and, you know, stop that. But it's an uphill battle.
Yeah, it is. Samuel, you say your friends call you Glades Renegade.
Right.
So saving the Everglades is like one of your, if not your main passion. Is that right?
Of course it is. I was born probably 35 miles west of Miami on one of the islands in the middle of the River of Grass. A lot of families were born out there. I was one of the last few. But I was born into my grandparents' culture, or the ways that they were brought up. We lived on small islands when I was a child, and on one island, we had our living quarters and also a pig or a hog that we kept. And we also had little gardens, but this is where we stayed at. On a nearby islands, we had gardens out there, and we would travel on the water out in the Everglades on a what they call a dugout canoe, which my grandparents were raised on. And so... that is where I'm from. My childhood experience was that I knew this place that was a paradise. Within my lifetime, 90% of the birds have disappeared. That's what the scientists are saying. But back when I was young, you know, there were different sounds or songs that were made by different frogs. And birds as well. In the morning, you hear different types of birds. At noon, you hear different types. In evenings, you hear different types of birds. And at nighttime, the area was more like a large lake. It's different now. But it was more like a large lake where the stars would always be bouncing off the water. And if the moon arise, you know, the whole place was lit up. So we call it Kahia lit, which means a reflection of heaven. That's the best way I can put it. Sometimes they call it the shimmering light. But if you were out there, the light would always shine down and it would light up. So it would, the river itself would reflect heavenly light. And so that was my experience. Till the age of 5, we moved to Big Cypress Seminole Indian Reservation. And this was a different environment. The land was, there was more high lands and a lot of trees out there. And this was a whole different experience.
I once took a helicopter trip from West Palm Beach to Flamingo. And at that level, just maybe 100 feet or so from the surface of the Everglades, to see the different colorations because of the different water depths, it was one of the most beautiful mosaics I'd ever seen. It was just breathtaking to see that.
Yeah, it is very beautiful, and the Everglades means a lot to me. And I do acrylic and oil paintings, sometimes pen and ink. And I found that a great meditation and healing for me. I like to paint of the Everglades and the times of my grandparents back when the times were pristine. And recently I started going back into music a lot more. I play guitar and do vocals. I used to travel and do songs 20 years ago. So I'm going back to music. It's my first love. But now I'm starting to paint Everglades and Everglades life on my guitars, and that keeps me closer to the instrument and guitar and keeps me closer to music and work with my art. And these are some things I hope to donate to good causes sometime soon.
What are the best ways for residents to learn and appreciate Seminole and Miccosukee cultures? Could you give us some advice for our listeners and their families?
Just going to the areas. The Seminoles, I'm sure, have a great museum. I know we have a nice village and museum you can visit, and there's people from the reservation who work there who are more than willing to share certain aspects of our culture and history. You just have to be willing to seek out the knowledge. So if you visit the reservations, you know, like I said, we have histories and we have museums and villages that are readily available.
Where I live, Big Cypress Seminole Indian Reservation, we have a museum called Big Cypress Atathiki Museum. And we also have a place called Billy Swamp Safari. We have great staff at both of these places, and I would invite anyone to come out here and experience being far, far away from the cities.
Mm. We're going to take a short break on the program. Before we do, let's give out our telephone number if you'd like to call in with a comment or question. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, that may be faster and best, radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. It's Topical Currents on Public Radio.
Topical Currents, and we were just listening to Samuel Tommy. He's of the Seminole community, Big Cypress Reservation, the Bird Clan. He's an artist and musician. And what were you playing? What flute are you playing now?
This is called Good Wishes from Beyond.
Okay.
Is and that also a cypress wood?
Cedar.
It's cedar.
Yeah, this is made out of cedar wood.
Also with us is William Osceola. He's a member of the Miccosukee Indian Tribe and a language and culture teacher at the tribe school. And George Zamanio is the CEO of History Miami and an archaeologist. He's been there 17 years, maybe it's 18 now. And we're talking about, Native American tribes here in South Florida on today's Topical Currents, Bonnie Berman and Joseph Cooper.
And George, tell us a little more about how you cover the native cultures at the museum at History of Miami.
Well, we have a permanent home for that story, you know, Tropical Dreams, People's History of South Florida. And that exhibition on the third floor of our building has been there for a while because it's very popular, especially with the school age kids and the children and the students. And it covers not only the prehistory, but also, you know, the early peoples that inhabited South Florida, the Seminole Indians, and that introduction by white settlers in South Florida, late 1800s, along the mouth of the river. You're talking about the Brickles and the Tuttles and everybody else that came along with them, Ralph Monroe. And that's the first
document. They did create a lot of trading up and down
exactly.
the Miami River.
And that trade along the Brickle Trading Post and other trading posts along the waterways were key. And this is the first place where, you know, you had resources and goods that were providing to Native people. It could be glass beads, fabric for creating patchwork, for clothing, and in exchange they were getting, I mean, it could be a pelt, a hide, alligator hide, and other goods from the Everglades. So that exchange went on for years and years, and it was a amicable relationship they had there. But that's a tradition that was continued for years. You know, I mean, trading along the waterways of South Florida has been going on for a long time, but that communication from the interior, from the Everglades to the mouth of the river in canoes, that goes back thousands of years.
And it was trading at the New River also.
There's a trading post in the Smallwood store in the southwest, the New River, the trading post up there, all throughout through Florida, yeah. But anyways, the exhibit's a great opportunity to learn about those traditions and those cultures. And what we also do is we have field trips, and we have programs that go out to the reservations, and we have partnerships with Ata Tiki and other museums to encourage those that communication and those relationships.
No, want to take a...
Let's take a telephone call. We've got Rose in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Rose.
Hi there. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
Quite an interesting conversation. I just want to know, you're talking about schools. My son is, 25 now, but when he was in fourth grade, they had a whole section he learned about Florida. And we learned so much about not being a native Floridian, learned so much about all the Indians, the history. And it's so good for our kids who are non-native to learn about that part of history. I want to know whether or not they still teach that in the schools in the fourth grade.
Okay. William?
Well, I can't speak to, Miami's public schools. I know in our school, we make that a priority to teach them the history about the language and culture. I know... From my experience going to public school in Connecticut, they didn't really go in depth on Native Americans, maybe like Squanto and something like that. But there wasn't really anything substantial or anything that was real in my experience.
Well, that's good to know, Rose, that they're teaching it.
Well, I'll just point out, at the museum, at one point, every fourth grader in South Florida did have to go to the museum to learn South Florida history. And unfortunately, that's changed
that's
quite
like
a bit.
A chore.
That's how I went.
Exactly. That's what she's talking about. Yeah.
Like that.
But unfortunately,
so they don't do that anymore.
It's not required reading anymore. Unfortunately, so then the history is a little bit diluted. I know, just based on experience, my wife's a teacher for years, elementary, that they cover general American, Native American history. And sometimes they don't even mention who the tribes are that live here in South Florida. So that is an issue. And that's how we try to supplement it by our own education and meeting that kind of curriculum.
It is a big concern for us.
Yes.
That's really sad because the kids learn so much about the Indians without, not Squanto, but the Tequesta, the Seminoles, and unfortunately public school teaching is not what it used to be, I guess. So, but great program, great program.
Samuel, continue.
Yes, it is a big concern for us that the history is not being told. Currently, I'm involved in working on a documentary. I'm involved with a person who's been teaching in Florida for the past 15 years, Florida history. But we are working on a documentary about Seminole history and the slavery times. But we feel that more history needs to be taught. And I appreciate your call.
Thank you, Rose. We have an emailer. George says, has either of you had exchanges with the Airy Residency Project? Are you familiar with that? They bring visual artists, writers, and musicians into the Everglades to explore and produce projects in their respective mediums.
I myself am not aware of
A-I-R-I-E.
that.
A-I-R-I-E. residency project?
I have not become familiar with the group yet.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe it's something.
Yeah, that you can maybe send us that info. We could look into to see what maybe we can start something with them if they're beneficial.
Right. Well, I don't know that he's involved, but. But it's something I'm sure you can look into.
Yeah. Okay, and okay. Let's go to Linda in Hollywood. You're up. Hi. Linda.
Hello.
Go ahead, Linda.
Yes, I went in the early 60s with a young lady by the name of Nellie Tiger. She and her husband took us out on the trail, and she showed us the Chiqui, where she was born and raised, on one of the small islands that you talked about. She took us out to the Shell Mounds, and we saw alligator wrestling and all of that. I would love to see some documentaries made, perhaps with WLRN-TV, to show those things that are still remaining before they disappear. Hopefully they won't completely disappear. But I thoroughly enjoyed learning about your heritage. She was one of the Indian princesses of the Tiger clan at that time. And I'm talking about in the early 1960s. So I live in Hollywood now. I lived in Miami at that time, but I live just about a mile west of Seminole Hard Rock right now in Hollywood, so off of Sterling Road. So at any rate, I've thoroughly enjoyed your show today, and hope you can get some documentaries made to show us a little more of your history.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Actually, at our museum, inside the museum, there are two little short films that go a little bit into our history. I'm not sure if the Seminoles have something similar or not. But the ones we have at our museum, it's just a few minutes, not too in-depth, but there's a little bit more.
William, tell us more about, because you're so in tune with the younger generation, of how the Miccosukees and the Seminoles can be more involved as far as steering Everglades environmentally?
Just by showing up to these, you know, there's protests or there's events that they can go to make their voices heard, because, again, since we are the people who live in this environment, we see firsthand before others the impact it has. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're kind of like the experts on it, so you want to go to experts if you want a valid opinion or something that's a little bit more substantial. So I think if we just, also online presence, you know, I've been trying to keep my students informed about situations like what's going on in Standing Rock, because stuff like that applies to all the tribes, including ourselves with the pipelines down here we have, the Sable pipeline and stuff. So just making yourself heard when it's appropriate and when you can.
Samuel Tommy, do you have hope about that?
Yes, I do. Starting with a lawsuit I have against primate facilities just on the northern borderline of Big Cypress National Preserve. 6 miles west of my reservation, there is a primate facility and three businesses out there. They have thousands of primates out there. Mm. And from what I have heard, they literally make some of the primates sick with diseases and deadly diseases and look for cures and so forth. It would be a serious problem, because the primates out there do carry Zika virus. So if the primates do escape because of hurricanes, or if a war was to break out, we're going to have thousands of primates out there, and it's going to be a disaster for everybody. So I do have a lawsuit against those companies as well. But the biggest concern for us right now, for my community and my tribe as well as the Miccosukee tribe and environmental activists, is that as of today, Florida Power and Light is planning to build and develop a power plant 4 miles north of my reservation, which is approximately 30 miles south of Lake Okeechobee.
Well, it's been an interesting hour. Thank you both.
Yeah, we wish you all the best with all your efforts, and thank you so much for sharing today. That's Samuel Tommy of the Seminole Community, Big Cypress Reservation, and the Bird Clan. He's an artist, musician, Everglades activist, filmmaker, among other things. Also with us is William Osceola. He's a member of the Miccosukee Indian Tribe, language and culture teacher at the tribe school. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
And George Zamanio is the CEO of History Miami. Thank you, George.
And thank you for joining us. Our program was produced by Polly Landis. Richard Ives is lead producer. Technical direction from online producer Jason Zabka. Of course, we have free audio archives to download at our website, WLRN.org. And tomorrow, we look at why people are drawn to celebrity with Julie Clam. She's written the book, The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.